You're listening to Experimental History. And Madam,
I'm Adam.
And this post is called How to Drive a Stake Through Your Own Good Heart. The subtitle is The Demise of the Optimize Guys. As always, doing this in one take. I was teaching at Columbia last year when the news broke. Our esteemed Ivy League university had been lying for years to increase its standing in the U.S. News and World Report college rankings. According to one of its own math professors, Columbia had juiced its stats by, among other things, claiming that 96.5% of its faculty are full-time, when the real number was probably more like 74%, reporting a 6-to-1 student-faculty ratio when the real ratio is between 8-to-1 and 11-to-1, counting the $3.1 billion it spent on patient care at its medical center as spending on instruction. We're teaching you how to be well by giving you a heart transplant. Those unscrupulous maneuvers were enough to catapult Columbia from number 18 to a tie for number 2 on the U.S. news list. As an employee of Columbia, I was ashamed. How can you take a school seriously when its own administrators can't uphold the same honor code that they make their students sign? But as a teacher, I was thrilled because I had used the U.S. news rankings as an example for this exact problem, and now I could gloat in front of my students for being an incredibly prescient professor. I was telling them about Goodhart's Law. Any measure that becomes a target ceases to be a good measure. And college rankings are a textbook Goodhart situation. Ranking schools may sound like a great idea, but it just encourages every school to game the system, rendering the rankings nearly useless. Some of the strategies schools used to pump their numbers were technically legal, but a bit distasteful. Boost your alumni giving rates by begging them to donate even tiny sums. Increase your average SAT score by paying your freshmen to retake it. Props to Baylor University for inventing that one. Offer lots of classes that are capped at 19 students so that they're technically under the 20-student cutoff that U.S. News cares about. Of course, it's way easier just to cheat, so lots of schools did that. Columbia is merely one of many universities caught cooking the books to raise their rankings, joining a hall of shame that includes Claremont McKenna, Temple, Villanova, Clemson, USC, George Washington University, and the University of Oklahoma. The U.S. News website currently lists 69 schools who have admitted to providing incorrect information in the past 3 years alone. Some of these could be honest mistakes, but notice that virtually all of them make the school look better than it should. Surely, it was a mere clerical error when the engineering school at the University of California, Riverside, reported that it spent $68.3 million on research when the actual number was $30.9 million. This is the inexorable logic of Goodhart's Law. Wherever there's a system, there will be people gaming it. Journals prefer to publish papers with statistically significant results, so researchers develop all kinds of clever hacks for slipping their stats under the threshold. The Affordable Care Act legally limited health insurance companies' profits, so those companies started buying clinics and pharmacies where the profits are unlimited. My local library used to raffle off prizes by giving kids a ticket for every book they read, so my sister and I would check out huge stacks of the shortest books we could find, speed read them, and turn them back in for tickets to little living Goodharts. As a footnote here, my sister and I actually did read the books, but our less scrupulous competitors didn't even do that. If you are reading this and you won that inflatable Garfield cup holder that could float in a swimming pool, providing hours of fun and relaxation on a hot summer day, and you got it by stuffing the raffle box with fraudulent tickets, gimme my Garfield, you swine. End footnote. That's where the discussion of Goodhart's Law usually ends. Oh, the hubris of people who design these systems. Oh, the nefariousness of the villains who game them. It's too bad we must live in a never-ending cat-and-mouse game where the good-hearted try to fix incentives and institutions faster than the bad-hearted can Goodhart them. But hey, that's why it's called Goodhart's Law and not Goodhart's temporary but ultimately solvable problem. And look, if we all spent a little more time meditating on the inevitable perversion of all incentives and the perpetual struggle to build and maintain systems that work, that would be great. But old Chucky Goodhart's observation has a lot more to give us. Goodhart's law doesn't just explain how bad actors fool institutions. It also explains how good actors fool themselves. That is, we think we're goodhearting each other, but we're often goodhearting ourselves. To show you how this happens, let me tell you about some stupid stuff I did in college. This section's called How to Be Your Own Terrible Boss. I went to a low-achieving high school in the middle of nowhere. It's currently ranked between 13,000 and 17,000 on the U.S. News and World Report's high school rankings. Yes, they have that now. When I got to college, I encountered something I had never seen before. People sitting in the library all day, studying. Some folks would be there till 3 a.m. These people really work hard, I thought to myself. I better keep up. So I plonked down in the library and got to work. I soon discovered, however, that I couldn't stay focused for more than an hour or two, let alone until the wee hours of the night. I'd descend into a screen-induced stupor for hours, flipping between tabs, checking Twitter, firing off some texts, scrolling through Facebook, refreshing the New York Times homepage, and Googling how to tell if eyes too far apart, etc., with a few seven-second bursts of actual work in between. I figured my classmates must be some kind of super students capable of infinite focus. Then I peeked at some of the laptop screens around me and beheld. Everybody else was doing exactly the same thing. We had all come to the library to study, and now all of us were goofing off. We were good-hearting ourselves. Am I studying effectively is a hard question to answer. How long did I spend in the library is way easier. Hours in library is a useful way to measure effectiveness of studying right up until it becomes a target. Once you try to maximize your library hours, you find lots of ways to spend them doing anything but studying. And suddenly, hours in library has nothing to do anymore with effectiveness of studying. Parenthetical, I saw the same thing happening at the gym. There were always guys there wandering around, lifting a weight or two, doing a squat, watching TV for a while, running for 5 minutes, checking their phone for a bit, then wandering around some more. Those guys think of themselves as spending 2 hours at the gym when they should actually think of themselves as spending 15 minutes working out. End parenthetical. You know how lots of jobs force you to hang around and look busy until quitting time, even when there's nothing to do, because your dumb boss only cares about you being there from 9 to 5 and doesn't actually know what you're doing with your time? That's obviously a stupid policy, but what's even stupider is inflicting it upon yourself. Such is the terrifying power of Goodhart's Law. You can create your own system and game it too. This section's called, Congratulations, you won a stupid game, here is your stupid prize. The point of all that studying was to get good grades. Unfortunately, grades are also a Goodhart trap. In fact, there are two Goodhart traps, one everybody talks about and one nobody talks about. Obviously, there's a Goodhart-type standoff between teachers and students. You're supposed to measure students' learning with points, but as soon as those points become a target, they cease to be a good measure. If you give points for attendance, for example, students will show up, sit in the back, and shop for shoes online during class. If you give points for participation, students will dutifully contribute nonsense. What I found most interesting about War and Peace was the war parts, but the peace parts were also pretty good. If you award points for doing well on the tests, students will badger you mercilessly with one question. Is this on the test? This is all classic Goodhart and everybody knows it. But the most devastating Goodharting happens not between students and teachers, but within students themselves. I got pretty good at figuring out how to game my college classes. Discover the professor's pet arguments and use them in essays, monitor lectures for hints about what's on the test, memorize all the vocab words and then forget them the day after the final exam, etc. Whenever I deployed these strategies and collected my A, I got this thrilling sense that I won. But what did I win? The biggest booby prize of all, a good grade that required zero learning. And I actually did want to learn. I thought I was good-hearting my professors, but I was only good-hearting myself. That's the tragedy of Goodhart's game. Even when you win, you lose, because the game is stupid. As I wrote in, I wanted to be a teacher, but they made me a cop, I tried to stop my own students from attempting to win this stupid game of grades with little success. Here's a quote from that older piece. On the first day of class, I would explain to students that, although I don't see the value in grades, and they are apparently secret anyway, that was true at Columbia Business School where I taught, I was contractually bound to give them. I told students they shouldn't care about these grades, and they should instead define success for themselves, which also happens to be one of the key tenets of good negotiation, which is what the class was about. Grades are monopoly money, I explained. And if you, for instance, claim that you're sick when you're really not, all you're doing is stealing monopoly money. This always got a big laugh. And then minutes later, I'd have students come up to me after class saying, but seriously, how do I get some of that monopoly money? End quote. So yes, it's usually possible to finagle a good grade in a class without actually learning much. We act as if those students have stolen something from their teachers, when really they've only stolen something from themselves, spending a whole lot of money and time in order to avoid getting educated. This section's called Steve Goes Beast Mode. Speaking of stupid games, my college friends and I used to play a lot of Halo, which is a video game where you're a bionically enhanced, emotionally stunted super soldier who shoots aliens. I was way better than my friends because my low-stress high school afforded me a lot of alien shooting time. I was so much better, in fact, that I won literally every match we played, except one. On some random Tuesday, my friend Steve went, as they say, beast mode. I watched with increasing desperation as he neared the game-winning 25 kills while I was only at 15, praying for a miraculous comeback that never came. As Steve crossed the finish line, I flew into a fury, leaping up and saying something like, "It doesn't even count! You could never beat me one-on-one!" And everyone was awkwardly like, "Okay, sure," until I got embarrassed and calmed down. Why did I care so much? The point of playing Halo is to have fun with your friends. But have fun with friends has no number attached to it. Score points does. And I had gotten so focused on scoring points that I forgot the only reason to score points is to have fun. Goodhart 3, me 0. It's not just me, of course. I've seen people melt down over lots of dumb games. Monopoly, Scrabble, Mario Kart, mini golf, charades, bowling, trivia, and croquet. Losing your cool after losing a game is mildly mortifying, but if 15 minutes of struggling for made-up points is enough to turn you into a howling, friendship-shredding monster, imagine how low you can sink when there's actual money and prestige on the line. If you take a high-paying job to provide for your family, and then you never see that family and they end up hating you, if you claw your way to the top only to find out you still feel as empty up there as you did at the bottom, if you get so obsessed with success that you lie and cheat to get it, then guess what? You got good-hearted. This section's called The Demise of the Optimized Guys. How can we stop good-hearting ourselves? If you break open a good heart situation, you'll find two components inside. Quantification, measuring something, and optimization, targeting that measure. Neither of these things is inherently bad, and neither is their combination. If you want to build more fuel-efficient cars, save enough for retirement, or pick the right Airbnb for a family reunion, you need to do some quantification and optimization. The problem is that no measure is ever perfect, and the more you rely on a measure, the more you multiply its imperfections, and the more consequential they become. I learned this the hard way when I was 10 years old and had what I thought was a life-changing revelation. I should just rush through all the boring things I have to do so I can spend more time doing fun stuff. If I just scarf down my lunch, run home from school instead of walking, shower in 90 seconds, etc., then I can use all that extra time to play video games and watch TV, and my life will be awesome. It seemed like the most obvious idea in the world. Just do whatever it takes to increase the number of minutes spent on Nintendo and cartoons. This turned out to be a disastrous policy. Hurrying all the time stressed me out. It infused my life with this constant sense of, come on, let's go already, that seeped into the things that, even into the things that were supposed to be fun. As I sat playing Pokemon, I wondered, but am I having enough fun? Which is a good way to have no fun at all. Also, showering is perfectly pleasant if you let yourself luxuriate a bit, and 90 seconds wasn't enough to remove my preteen stink anyway. After a frazzled, disappointing, and smelly 2 days, I went back to normal, unhurried life. Why didn't it work? The culprits were both quantification and optimization, First, minutes spent playing Nintendo and watching cartoons was an imperfect measure of living a satisfying life. Not all minutes spent at the TV are actually fun, and not all minutes spent away from it are boring. Second, targeting that measure not only eliminated all of my fun non-TV time, it also sapped some of the fun from the TV time itself. I was, at 10 years old, trying to be what I now think of as an optimized guy. This is the kind of person who's always trying to engineer the best life for themselves, whether it's through replacing their meals with nutritive slurries, or keeping dossiers on their professional contacts so they can network more effectively, or obsessively tracking their sleep and calibrating the dimness and temperature of their bedroom to squeeze out another minute of REM. If you just cobble together enough life hacks, the thinking goes, you'll end up at the good life. The error of the optimized guy is believing that life is stupidly simple. They're right that life is full of many stupid, well-defined problems that can be overcome with engineering, but these aren't the important problems. At the center of life is a tangle of mysteries, irreducible woo, if you will, that's a reference to an older post, and so no amount of quantification nor optimization is going to solve them for you. But optimized guys have a hard time figuring that out, because the engineering approach can fool you into thinking you're making progress when you're really not. If you try to optimize, say, the number of dollars in your bank account, it will seem like you're succeeding as long as that number is going up. Your investment portfolio can't count the toll you're taking on your relationships, and you might not realize that toll until it's too late, and your retirement party is full of people who are glad you're leaving and would prefer it if you were already dead. That's why, while optimized guys sometimes end up rich and successful, they're never someone I look up to. They always seem like they're solving all of their problems except the ones that really matter. Even as all of their key performance indicators increase, they never get less anxious or more satisfied. They're envied by many and admired by none, except, of course, other aspiring optimized guys. And whenever I slip into my ever-latent optimized guy persona, I always end up less happy, usually by fretting over whether I'm having the most fun possible. It's good to have money. It's good to be successful, and it's good for people to like you. It's bad to optimize for any of those things. Optimize for money and you'll never enjoy what you earn. Optimize for success and you'll end up powerful but hated. And optimize for social approval and you'll become a spineless people pleaser with no sense of self. There's a tweet here that I really like from someone named Alice Maz. Quote, only morons and cowards respond to incentives. Healthy people do what they want to do if reasonably practical. Great people do what they want to do no matter what. Systems can't constrain the people who run the systems. They have to believe and care. End quote. This section's called Reject Thousands, Make Millions. The best way to avoid getting good-hearted, then, is to look at optimized guys and learn what not to do. The quintessential optimized guy is Sam Bankman-Fried, the former crypto billionaire who is standing trial after making lots of people's money disappear. But his example isn't actually that instructive, because when you see an optimized guy fail, you can always reason that he simply didn't optimize correctly. No, if you really want to learn something, you have to see how terrifying it looks when an optimized guy succeeds. For such an example, may I suggest Richard M. Friedland, president of Northeastern University from 1996 to 2006, who successfully maneuvered his institution from the middle of the pack to the top tier of the U.S. News & World Report rankings. To quote his Boston Magazine profile, quote, Friedland swept into Northeastern with a brand new mantra, recalibrate the school to climb up the ranks. There's no question that the system invites gaming, Freeland tells me. We've made a systematic effort to influence the outcome. He directed university researchers to break the U.S. News code and replicate its formulas. He spoke about the rankings all the time, in hallways and at board meetings, illustrating his points with charts. He spent his days trying to figure out how to get the biggest bump up in the charts for his buck. He worked the goal into the school's strategic plan. We had to get into the top 100, Freeland says. That was a life or death matter for Northeastern. End quote. Freeland succeeded. Northeastern was ranked 162 when he took the job, and it rose to 98 just after he retired. Now it stands at 53. For an optimized guy, this is a huge win. It is, however, footnote. It is, however, a drop from its number 44 spot last year, thanks to a change in U.S. news methodology. That's the thing about gaming the system. Once you start, you can never stop. It's tempting to look at Freeland's career with awe, but the appropriate feeling is horror. Everybody agrees that the U.S. news rankings are stupid. Rising in those rankings is also stupid. Freeland himself wrote that a university president's main job is to articulate the institution's values. The value he articulated was, make a magazine give us a lower number. And the world is worse for Freeland's efforts. For instance, one way Freeland upped his numbers was by encouraging as many applications as possible so that he could issue lots of rejections and thus artificially lower Northeastern's acceptance rate. Footnote here, U.S. News removed acceptance rates from their rankings a few years ago, but rock-bottom admission rates continue to generate headlines every year, and they almost certainly help schools improve their important peer assessment scores, which are part of the rankings. Applications also net the school lots of fees. Northeastern charges each applicant $100, meaning the school made up to $9 million from rejecting 90,393 students in 2023 alone. Another footnote here. I can't find data on how many students apply for and receive application fee waivers, so this is an upper bound. Just keep that in mind. Literally, no one benefits from this scheme in which thousands of 18-year-olds pay to receive rejection letters in the mail, except perhaps Northeastern's current president, who lives in an $8.9 million apartment and gets chauffeured to work. And that was the 2009 or 2007 price, so it's almost certainly way more than that now. Parenthetical, other less than virtuous strategies employed by Freeland and his successor, recruiting low-achieving but rich students from abroad who could pay full tuition, networking extremely hard to earn higher ratings from other institutions on U.S. News' annual survey, deliberately responding with junk data to that same survey, and personally lobbying the guy behind the curtain at U.S. News to rejigger the rankings to Northeastern's benefit. End parenthetical. It's not even clear if Freeland's efforts were good for the students who actually go to Northeastern. As a former administrator put it, quote, Freeland was much more focused on ratings and not necessarily on what it took to improve the quality of the institution. Which makes sense, because U.S. News can't actually measure the things that make a college good. Things like how much students learn, whether it provides a place for students to become the best versions of themselves, etc. And those are exactly the kind of touchy-feely liabilities that schools have to ditch if they want to supercharge their stats. Parenthetical. Also, I have to mention this delightfully apropos Rate My Professor review of Freeland from when he returned to teach a history class. Quote, he is an extremely harsh grader, and only once you understand how arbitrary his grading system is will you do decently. It's too perfect. I'm picking on Freeland here because he was so brazen and proud about how he gained the rankings. Most schools do this, of course, just less well, and only some of them get caught. There are no heroes here. It's all dumb. That's what you have to recognize if you want to bust out of your personal good heart hell. People will cheer for you even as you're good-hearting yourself. Way to go, jumping through those hoops. Congratulations on being the best at playing the game. You made the number go up. Woohoo! I have wasted a good chunk of my life chasing exactly that kind of praise. I thought I was winning, but the only way to win Goodhart's game is to walk away. And you should believe me on that. I must be very smart and trustworthy because I used to teach at a university that was, until recently, ranked as second best in the world. That's experimental history. Thank you so much for listening. You can get all the posts at www.experimental-history.com, as well as the mystery posts, like my course on negotiation, as well as some spiritual successors of some of the posts that I read, if you like them. Good Conversations Have Lots of Doorknobs, there is How to Get Funnier and Why You Shouldn't. If you like the blog and want it to exist, you can sign up for a paid subscription. This is how I stay alive. And without this, I would die. I would lay down and die. That's one way you can support the blog. You also share it with people, leave a review. All this, helps me live. So thank you for doing it. The music is by Brandon Rojar. The photographs are by my dad, and I will be back soon.